Good evening. Hi, everybody. I am an alcoholic. My name is Ashley. Thank you so much, Phil, for the meeting and for everyone who's doing service and for everyone attending. Wow, it's nice to be with the good people of Tennessee and with everyone who's attending from around North America. I really enjoy being in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, the fellowship and the program. And I have a sobriety date. It is the 30th of December, 2006. I love my sobriety date. It's very special to me. I'm going to hang on to it with all I've got. I have no intention of giving it up with the help of my higher power and these 12 steps, 12 traditions, and 12 concepts of service, and the first word of the first step, which is we. I also have a neat little family twist in that my sobriety date is the belly button birthday of my papa, my maternal grandfather, and he was an alcoholic, and he did not have the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous, although I understand from his second wife that on occasion when they had a row that he would cross the border from Eastern Kentucky and Appalachia and go to a meeting. And I think that, you know, he would have enjoyed AA and he certainly would have benefited from it. And that my sobriety date is a little bit of a gift from him too. So I've got lots of reasons to want to stay sober today. I do meet the requirement for membership as suggested in our third tradition, our inclusion statement. You know, we refuse none who wish to recover and have a desire to stop drinking. And I do have a sponsor. Her name is Arisa. She's wonderful. She has so much to offer. And the more time that I spend with her, the more I understand it behooves me to make really good use of my sponsor by, you know, working the 12 steps with her. She's also my service sponsor, which means that we're really deep into the 12 traditions and the 12 concepts for world service, which is our probably least known legacy. You know, we're a program of 36 principles of three legacies. And I call her every week. I also text her and, you know, do spontaneous calls to check in with her. You know, it says in our 10th step that if I have something in my nightly review that I need to share with somebody, like my husband just went down the street to buy a beer, interestingly. He's not a problem drinker and his drinking doesn't bother me. But I kind of cheated at cards the other day. I saw his cards and I felt like that was cheating. I was like, I better report that to my sponsor. So that was an independent, you know, prompt to call her. And she was like, I think it just makes you human because you kind of look when they flash them at you. And I also sponsor other women in this program, some of whom are here tonight. And boy, isn't that a pleasure and a delight. I mean, I am so privileged to walk hand in hand and shoulder to shoulder with women in AA. And I just love them. And they are precious and dear to me. And I'm so honored to have their trust and to have a sense of safety in a world that is often so unsafe. And I have a home group. I put the name of it and the link to it in the chat. It's called the Beacon Group. I'm a pretty mobile person. So on the flyer, it says I was in Franklin, but I'm actually up here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I spend time in Africa and in Europe. So I claim the Beacon Group as my home group, and we meet Mondays through Fridays at 12 noon Eastern. We're very solution focused, and we have a speaker for 30 minutes on this step. We go through all 12 steps consecutively, just rolling through those 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. They read from the book, share on the step in detail with weight and depth, and then we break into small groups, and everyone has the opportunity to share. So I hope you'll join us sometime. It's a powerful, powerful group. You know, I don't know about y'all, but I lived with a lot of problems before I got here, and I feel pretty done with my problems. I would like to live in the solution today. So those are kind of the basics, and I wanted to tell you a little bit about how I got here, because we all come to AA in different ways, especially in these contemporary times, and then tell you a little bit about, you know, my drinking, and then go through the 12 steps, because that's, you know, what AA is. It's the 12 steps. And so, you know, my family background includes a lot of alcoholism. Going back to my great-grandparents' generation, my great-grandmommy was a flophouse street alcoholic who murdered my great-grandfather in her disease and dysfunction, and she burned down the family business and left the state with the money that she was able to abscond with. And that's just one of the family stories. You know, so you can imagine the holidays and the stories that we told were pretty snappy. And there's a lot more like that, but there's no need to go into detail because you get a broad sketch of what the ick was like in my alcoholic family system. And I was very adversely affected by the drinking of both of my parents, as well as their other issues and an untreated, undiagnosed mental illness in one of my parents. And I had the kind of childhood where when the police came to the house, when they left, I stood on the front porch with my arms hanging limp by my sides, wondering why they didn't take me with them. And my parents loved me very much, but it was a family that didn't work very well. You know, it was kind of a failed family system. And none of that makes me an alcoholic. It does make me a good member of the Al-Anon family groups, our sister program. And I came into AA through our sister program. I call it coming in through the back door. And interestingly, when I went to my first Al-Anon meeting, I went to treatment for my adult child of alcoholic issues. And so I already had a sponsor and I was already familiar with the 12 steps. And I went to my first Al-Anon meeting after I had been in inpatient treatment. And I didn't know any better because no one had taught me better. And this is why the traditions became so important to me early in my recovery and why I think it's very important to handle this appropriately at meetings and visit with newcomers and uphold our traditions. I shared non-Al-Anon literature at my first Al-Anon meeting because I just didn't know any better. And the chairperson corrected me. And of course, I got a resentment and I got my little sensitive feelings hurt and I would not go back to Al-Anon. Because didn't they know I had been to the best treatment center, blah, blah, blah. But of course I wanted recovery. I already had a sponsor. I had already started to work the 12 steps. And so all I could think to do was go to open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, where I found out that alcoholism is contagious. And I caught alcoholism from y'all and from the literature of the big book. Now, of course, I'm being a little bit humorous there. What really started to happen was I identified with what I heard in the rooms. And because I was going to a meeting where there was, you know, people like Steve L., who's Phil's grand sponsor, were sharing and they read from the book, I began to identify with what I heard. And I also wanted what was so attractive in other people. And here are the kinds of things that I heard from the preface of the 12 and 12. You know, it said that, I don't need to read it. I know it by heart. AA's 12 steps are a series of principles, spiritual in nature, which if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become usefully and happily whole. And I thought that sounded really beautiful. I thought that sounded really beautiful. And I also heard that in steps 1, 2, and 3, I could make peace with a God of my understanding. And I really needed a God of my understanding. And that in steps 4, 5, 6, and 7, I could make peace with myself. And I had a lot of chaos and depression and violence inside of myself. And the idea of making peace with myself was very attractive. And then in steps 8 and 9, I could make peace with others. And in our eighth step in the 12 and 12, Bill writes, defective relations with other human beings has been the cause of all our woes, including our alcoholism. I mean, I had defective relationships with other human beings. So in steps 8 and 9, to make peace in my relationships was an epic idea. And then I heard in steps 10, 11, and 12, I could grow in peace. So I was coming to open AA meetings and my mind was being blown. And then in the doctor's opinion, I started to hear about this, the twofold nature of alcoholism and how I had this obsession, which my sponsor explained to me is just an idea that overcomes all other ideas. You know, because I didn't think I was this crazed, obsessive person. It just meant that when I thought about taking a drink, the idea of taking a drink overtook me. And that when I tried to stop, I couldn't stay stopped and I would pick up again, even though I didn't really want to. And I was very preoccupied on the days I was going to drink. And, you know, for me, my drinks were fancy cocktails and white wine and pink champagne. But I'm telling you what, when I was going to have it, I had to have it. There was this one time I was in, Central America and I was at a hotel and I ordered a bottle of something from the restaurant, and it was taking seemingly forever because I'm an impatient alcoholic for the bottle to come. And I could not bear the wait because my obsession was raging, and I had to get up and go to the bar to order something immediately to drink before I could go back to my table and sit and wait for that bottle of wine to come. You know, that's when the obsession kicked in. It just was pulsing through my body. So that's what I was reading about in the doctor's opinion. And then I heard in the doctor's opinion, when I ingested the drink, I had this phenomenon of craving kick in that meant I got this sense of ease and comfort that came at once when taking the drink. And then I had to have more. Even if I swore I was going to have one, if I swore I was going to have three, if I was going to limit the number of drinks, I had to have more, 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 more. And so I caught alcoholism in AA. And then what really did me in is on page 30 in our chapter, more about alcoholism, and I want to read this, and I'm going to read it in the first person because it describes me so perfectly. And if you want to read along, it's page 30, chapter 3. I had been unwilling to admit I was a real alcoholic. I didn't want to think I was bodily and mentally different from my fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that my drinking career had been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove that I could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, I could control and enjoy my drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. That tanked me. That was it. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. I learned that I had to concede fully to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. I've lost the ability to control my drinking. And then there are all these other lines over on 31. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, I tried to prove myself an exception to the rule and therefore non-alcoholic. I've tried hard and long enough to drink like other people. You know, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on the drinking because the drink problem today has been solved with me, but I did want to qualify because this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I had a very strange, distorted attitude toward the institution of alcohol. You know, when I tried to take my first drink when I was in the fifth grade because my dad had leftover booze from a party, you know, because I thought that that was what sophisticated little kids did. And I had consequences from that immediately. One of my little girlfriends went home and told her parents, and they said, Ashley's too fast. You can't be friends with her anymore. You know, and then fast forward to being in a hotel room alone after having had quite a lot to drink and having these quasi-religious insights, profound thoughts, you know, really big time insights. I was by myself, so I had no one with whom to share all this profundity. So I did the most natural thing. I called myself and left myself a voicemail because somebody needed the benefit of all this wisdom. And so I left myself a voicemail. Then I made myself get sick so I would have less of a hangover. And then I woke up the next day, did the natural thing, checked my voicemail, and I was like, what is this gibberish? What is this nonsense? I'm like, what is this? And it was me talking to myself, completely inebriated. And when I read this in my first step to my sponsor, she said, Ashley, you know, that is not sane behavior. That is not sane behavior. And that's how I arrived at my first step two. That's how I arrived at my first step two. And I learned some really important things about Alcoholics Anonymous when I took my first step two. You know, and it starts on page XIV, where it says, you know, we are not allied or affiliated with any religion, with any institution, with any sect, with any denomination. And it says on page 26 in the 12 and 12 that AA doesn't demand that you believe anything. And it says emphatically in our literature, in other multiple places, that we are not required to believe any particular way. And then in that beautiful second step, that we came to believe in a power greater than ourselves, that we are each given the dignity of finding this creative intelligence, the spirit of the universe. There's so many different words that are used for it in our chapter to the agnostic. And I began to explore the idea that I could find a personal higher power that would just love me and adore me and support me. And in that beautiful operative word of the third step, care for me. And I want to tell you a little second step story. I was in Eastern Congo, where I have spent some time doing work that's really difficult, and I'm going to talk about violence and sexual violence in my story. So please take care of yourself if that's a hard thing for you to hear about. And, I was with some young women who were survivors of very severe sexual violence. And I'm used to this work. I've been doing it for a long time. I myself am a survivor of childhood sexual abuse and child rape. And I've done a lot of work on that. I've gotten outside professional help, and I've come a long way in my journey. But on this particular night, when I was back where I was sleeping, I was shattered, inconsolable, shattered in my room, could not get my act together, useless to anyone. And I knew that I was having a step two dilemma. I had completely lost my power greater than myself, and I was insane with my grief. And so I was trying to work step two big and bad. You know, I need a power greater than colonialism, a power greater than all of the troubles that have besieged the Democratic Republic of Congo for generations. And I was going through this litany of things and really trying to force a solution. And it was not working. I mean, I was snot slinging, crying. And I had this little envelope with which I travel and put little mementos in. And I opened it up, and out fell a picture of my kitty cat. My little kitty cat, Percy. And all of a sudden I realized that he was this loving little kitty who just accepted me as I was and was non-punitive and was always glad to see me when I opened the door in the morning, even though I had put him out at night, which I felt so guilty about. And I know that this may sound totally weird to people, but I realized that the kind of higher power I needed was personal and intimate and loved me in my brokenness and was just right there with me in that moment. And then I found this prayer with which I had been traveling that said, "My God, I don't know where I'm going. I don't know where I am. I don't know if I'm on the right road. And even if I were on the right road, I would know nothing of it. But I believe I have the desire to please you. And I think the desire pleases you. And I know you will never leave me to face my perils alone." And I was just soothed and consoled. And I settled down and I realized that I'm in the footwork department. I'm not in the outcome department. And I just needed to do the next good, right, honest thing and show up for those girls the next day, do what was in front of me to do, and turn it all over to a higher power of mercy and just love people where they were and do what I was given to do in my life and trust that this care in step three was going to be there for me and just let love come through me. And so that was a step two experience that I had. And I've taken step two in a lot of different ways. But that was a really personal one for me. And then step three, you know, I want to talk a little bit about alcohol because the program is portable and I can take steps one, two, and three on alcohol anywhere, anytime, any place. You know, and earlier in my sobriety, I remember being at a fancy dinner party and the champagne came out and the waiter was carrying the tray. And I realized I'd forgotten to get on my knees before I left my hotel room to ask my higher power to keep me sober that night. And when I saw that tray of champagne, it was like the Hollywood Klieg lights flashed on, shone on the glass of champagne. The volume went down in the room. Everything sparkled around that glass. And I was so drawn to it. And I turned to the person with whom I was attending the party and I said, "Oh my gosh, I forgot to take the first three steps and to ask my HP to keep me sober. Can I do that right here with you?" And they said, "Of course." And we went and we sat down in a booth and I just said, "God, I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable by me. I believe that you can restore me to sanity. And in this moment, I turn my will and my life over to your care. Please keep me sober." And that fascination with that drink just evaporated. And I stayed sober that night in the middle of that party with everybody drinking. If you are new to Alcoholics Anonymous, you can take those first three steps anywhere and you can stay sober under any circumstances. But step three also teaches me how to make decisions about other things in my life, you know, and I think, and I heard my friend, my recovery sister, Sam, say this once, you know, that step three decision is the most important decision I will ever make in my life. And it teaches me to keep things in perspective. And it's also related to our third concept for World Service, which says the right of decision makes effective leadership possible. And what that means to me is I'm the leader of my own life and I have the right to make decisions for my life. And when I get new information, I'm allowed to change my mind. I'm allowed to update my decision. And I was asked to, in a very public way, come forward about someone who had been engaging in criminal behavior. And the behavior against me had happened in the 1990s, and I had talked about it privately. I had talked about it publicly in 2016, but nobody paid attention. And then in 2018, I was asked to talk about it publicly in a very large forum. And I was like, I need to think about this because there might be all kinds of ramifications for me. They might sue me for defamation and slander. They've got all these resources, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I thought, I'm going to do what I do. I'm going to go for a run, laced up my shoes, to, you know, was praying about it as I was running. And I remembered what my recovery sister, Sam, said. I've already made the most important decision I'll ever make. I've made my step three decision. And this is just the right thing to do. This is just the right thing to do. And in AA, we do the right thing. You know, tradition 12, we put principles above personalities. I'm putting the principle above this person's personality. And it became so simple and so obvious that, of course, I was going to come forward and do the right thing. And again, be in the footwork department and not in the outcome department. And that's exactly what I did. And I did it with a lot of peace. I did it with a lot of peace. It was a very simple and straightforward decision. So in my step four, you know, everyone who knows me knows that I love the line that the book gives me, because it's just, it gives me this grace that the world and its people are indeed often quite wrong. And I just love that AA gives me that, you know, that it acknowledges that I have been hurt. And in my case, you know, as a survivor of violence, people have been quite wrong. But the book also goes on to say that that's as far as most of us ever got. That's as far as most of us ever got, you know. And my question for myself is, how free do I want to be? How free do I want to be? You know, and so I become prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. And that's going to be really related to my step eight and my step nine, where I get that freedom. And, you know, when I talk to my sponsor, she'll always say to me, when I'm talking about an exchange I had with someone that was uncomfortable, or where I allowed my feelings to get hurt, or that didn't feel good. And she'll say, well, what were they right about? What were they right about? And so I have to comb through this inventory and see where the other person may have had something to offer about which they were indeed accurate. And, I don't want to I just kind of want to go back to step three. I don't want to skip over all the stuff about step three, about self-will run riot, and we live by self-propulsion, and we're in collision. And I mean, all of that is obviously terribly important. And to turn our will and our life over to the care of God means that, my selfishness and my self-centeredness is something that I work on abdicating, and that I'm trying to align my will with my higher powers on a daily basis. And hey, when I first came into AA, my sponsor gave me an assignment to read the third step in the 12 and 12 every day, twice a day for a month. And if I missed a reading, I had to start the 30 days over. So that's definitely a part of the step three experience for me, and I don't mean to shortchange it. And the other thing that's important to me about that language in step three is, you know, properly armed with the facts about myself, I still can do great harm. You know, properly armed with all the information, I still can behave and be out of integrity. So I need to align my will with my higher power's will. So going back to the step four, you know, there, and I relate it very much to step 10 because I'm very current in my sobriety today. In the 12 and 12 in step 10, Bill says, you know, the hours that we spend doing this reflection and this inventory make all the rest of the hours of the day worthwhile. And I'm very much in that mode in my recovery today of being in that spot check inventory. Like I did one today. My partner and I were walking on the beach and we were talking about something. And I realized that I regressed a little bit and went back to a time when I was 15 years old where I'd been badly hurt. It was around the sexual violence that I experienced, and I had to do a spot check inventory because I realized I was not walking in the present moment. I wasn't hearing him anymore in terms of what he was sharing about that was going on with him. I was back reliving a traumatic experience, and it was only by doing a spot check inventory and that radical self inquiry that I was able to recognize that I was slip sliding down to an old place. And we went and we sat down and I said, you know, I'm about to go mute, which is where I go to when I go to my traumatic place. And I was able to share and self-disclose and then, you know, got in the car. And in the old days when I didn't have tools, that could have lasted for 3 days. And we were deciding, you know, whether we were going to listen to a funny podcast or listen to some music. And I found a fun music that I really love that's upbeat, to which I know all the words, and I put it on. And that just lifted my mood and popped me out of it. And I was able to carry on. And that's how I have my resilience today as a woman in recovery who is empowered, you know, and it was a result of doing that spot check inventory, which is related to steps 4 and steps 10. And I also want to share about step 4, you know, as someone who grew up with the ick and the alcoholic family system, as I've often shared before, you know, there's a lot of times that those of us who've been hurt put things on our inventory for which we're not responsible. And the role of a good discerning sponsor who can sustain love in hearing a step 5 is to winnow away the things for which we are not responsible, and then to hold us accountable for the things which we are responsible for later in our lives, like carrying the rage or re-victimizing ourselves. Or, you know, the first woman in AA who heard my 5th step, there were things when I was a child, like when I was a little kid, that I had on that 4th step for which I wasn't responsible because I was defenseless, I was vulnerable, I was dependent, and I had just internalized the message that my parents told me in order to justify abandoning and neglecting me. Like I lived alone for 2 years as a child growing up because my dad was out drinking and drugging. And so he put $50 in an envelope and left the state. And I lived entirely alone in an apartment in Lexington, Kentucky. And when I say entirely alone, there's a period at the end of that sentence. And there's really nothing further to say. I was by myself. And then my mom did the same thing. Her circumstances were different. She was out celebrating great success, but she left me alone in a farmhouse in Williamson County, Tennessee, for an entire year. And there were things that I did to survive, you know, to get by, where I thought I was bad and wrong. And the first woman who heard my 5th step, she was like, you were a kid. And it's not a child's responsibility to prevent her own damage in those situations. But when I grew up and I'm 27 and I'm raging, or I'm cussing, or I'm reacting in these bombastic ways, and I'm out of control, I am responsible for that. Because it's not my fault I have a disease, but I become responsible for treating my disease when I have the education that there is a solution. And so that's the discernment in a good step 5. So the other thing I love about step 5 is hearing step 5s for other women and being able to hold that sacred space, to hold their hearts gently, you know, admit I was taught in the first word of step 5, admitted to God, to ourselves and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs, is that I grant access. You know, I just grant access to this really tender part of myself. And when another woman grants me that access, it's a deep honor and privilege. And, you know, as I said earlier, for there to be safety in a world that's so often unsafe is really beautiful. And I want to tell you a step six and seven story that just happened. I've referenced rage a little bit, and I know whereof I speak, because when I came in, I was full of it. And, I was told that my rage preceded me when I walked into a room. And I was told I was so angry that I was intimidating. And then I would get mad at people for thinking I was intimidating, because I really just wanted to be close to people and to belong. And so I just put people off. And I don't know about you, but I remember once this telemarketer calling, and I bellowed at the telemarketer, and they hung up on me. And I think it usually works the other way around. You know, I could be just absolutely scathing. And what I have learned today in Alcoholics Anonymous, if I have a difference with someone, and this is the value of our traditions and our concepts. Well, first of all, I got relief from the rage by taking step six and step seven, became entirely willing to have God remove my defects of character and humbly asked him to do so. And wasn't it a relief to get rid of that rage? I mean, it burned up so much energy. And like it says at the end of step 10 and 11, we sleep better because we're not foolishly burning up energy. I mean, that was the great gift of my first starting to practice step 10 and 11. It was just getting some damn sleep. in our tradition 10, we talk about outside issues and opinions. And what I learned is that, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I can stand for something without standing against my fellows. And that in that first tradition where we talk about common welfare, we also talk about unity. And there's this very important line in the first tradition in the 12 and 12 where Bill says that the group matters and so does the individual. Because most individuals cannot recover unless there is a group. It becomes plain that the group must survive or the individual will not. So the first tradition starts to heal me of my binary either or black and white alcoholic thinking. The first tradition teaches me both, and both things are true. The group matters and the individual matters. And so the first tradition, common welfare and unity, teaches me that maybe I can disagree with you or one of us can be wrong, and it can happen with dignity, respect, and kindness. Or someone can exhibit objectionable behavior and I can speak up, and I can do so in a really loving tone of voice. And when I bring in tradition 10, which talks about no opinion on outside issues, hence our name ought never be drawn into controversy, that I can have conflict without being controversial. And so I want to tell you the story because it happened in AA. I was listening to a speaker, and he was actually telling a step six and seven story, and he used a word that is pejorative and demeaning towards women who are trapped in prostitution. And it's an old word, and it would be the equivalent of using the R word for people who have developmental disabilities or something like that. And everybody laughed. The whole room just erupted into laughter. Maybe not everybody, but as far as I could hear, there was a huge laugh. And I didn't laugh. And afterwards, I thanked him. I went to the receiving line and I thanked him for his share, as I always thank the speakers. And then I thought about it, and I know that about myself, if I'm speaking from the podium, and I travel a lot around the world, and I do things that are culturally inappropriate and insensitive because I just don't know. And I would want someone to tell me if I made an inappropriate remark or something that was insensitive or not right for the context, because I just didn't know better. And so I decided I would reach out to him and ask him if we could just have a conversation. Well, of course, he thought I was calling to praise his talk. And I was like, look, this isn't what you think it is. And I just am offering some social information. And the reason I was able to do that is because, number one, I am responsible for Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. That teaches me that in concept one. And this is the how we apply the concepts to our personal lives and personal relationships. In concept three, as I said, I have the right to make decisions when I get new information. And I have information that he does not have. That does not make me a know-it-all. It just means that I know more at this time. And that's something that my sponsor taught me. In concept four, it says that participation is built into our entire service structure, and I'm participating in the well-being of everyone in the room, because there are men and women in AA who've been in that position and who've been exploited and for whom that word is deeply painful. And so I was participating. And then this is really the censure. Concept five says that the minority voice has a duty and an obligation to speak up, that the minority voice has the right to petition and appeal and to be heard. And I was that minority voice, and I was clinging to concept five, teaching me that I had a duty and an obligation to speak up. And you know what he said to me? I have told that joke hundreds of times, and you're the first person who's ever had the courage to approach me. Now, will he keep telling the joke? I don't know. But now he has the information. And it doesn't matter who it was who told the joke, because we put the principle above the personality. It's not who said it. It was what was said. And what I love about these traditions and concepts is that here in my family of AA, it teaches me how to have the courage to resolve these things. And then I can go out into my family, you know, where there's radically different political perspectives, how to go out into the world in which I live and have these differences. And as I said, stand for something without standing against my fellows, you know, how to have that 10, 11 and 12, be at peace and grow in peace in a difficult world. So thank you for letting me tell that story. It was really important to me, you know, and it was a scary thing to do. And I did talk to quite a few other women about it, and they were very uncomfortable, but I represented myself. I didn't represent anyone else. So I want to tell you a story about something that happened to me on the 5th of February in 2021. I was, again, in Congo. It figures prominently in a lot of my stories. And I was doing what we do there, walking in the rainforest and very remote, second lung of the planet, the Central African rainforest at about, I think I started at, you know, 4:30 in the morning. So it was still dark. And when we walk, it's a very narrow little path. I mean, it's not much wider than that. And the rainforest is grown up all around the path. And I wear a stretchy band with a flashlight on it, a head torch. And my head torch was really dim. I had put fresh batteries in it just the night before because it had been dim the day before. But I had managed to walk safely with the dim light the day before. But on this day, the 5th of February, it was really difficult to see. And I was trying to keep up with the person in front of me to borrow light off their lamp. And I just was really struggling to walk. And eventually I tripped over something. And when I tripped and fell, my leg broke, and it broke in four places. And when the leg broke in four places, I felt it. And I cried out as I was falling, my leg is breaking. And I also sustained severe nerve damage, and my foot was paralyzed. And as you can imagine, the pain that just ripped through my body and just like sheared through my nervous system was extraordinary. And I dragged myself over to the side of the trail, and thus began a very long, almost 3-day odyssey before I was finally able to arrive at an emergency room. And the first part of this experience involved laying on the rainforest floor for 5.5 hours. And what this has to do with Alcoholics Anonymous is that the principles of AA were with me while I was in this agony. First of all, I felt the we of the first step, in that I knew no one could do this pain for me, but I knew that I was not alone, because there was this man named Dieu Merci who sat on his haunches for 5.5 hours supporting my rattly broken bones. He bolstered them, and he was perfectly still that entire time. And I knew it was just like being in the rooms of AA, where we listen to each other's stories and witness each other's pain and journey. And his empathy and his compassion were so deep. And I knew that no one could take the pain away for me, but that I was being witnessed. And it was just like our fellowship in that way. And then I knew I couldn't have any expectations. And we talk so much about, you know, not having any expectations, and our serenity is directly proportionate to our acceptance and our low expectations. You know, I couldn't have any expectations about if I was going to get help, when I was going to get help, what that help was going to look like. I had to completely let go of knowing, and that's what our slogan, Let Go and Let God, means to me. I let go of the need to know, because I couldn't know what was, I mean, I knew how I got into that rainforest. It takes 2 days. And I knew it was going to take me days to get out with 4 broken bones. The other way that the principles of AA were with me was that, my step two, my higher power concept, you know, I didn't have the energy to pray. All of my energy was going towards survival. All I knew is that I have a higher power concept in which my higher power suffers with me. My higher power suffers with me. And I just clung to that, you know. And there's this book, the name of which I won't mention because it's not published by AA or the Grapevine, but it's about the spirituality of the 12 steps. And there's a chapter for each of the 12 steps. And then there's this 13th chapter in which the author talks about how higher power suffers with us. I had just read that chapter the day before I fell. And I've had that book since 2006. And I had taken it to the rainforest with me, and I read it the day before I fell. And I would sit there and scream and howl and bite a stick. And a man had to come and with his bare hands adjust my leg and try to put the bones back into shape so I could be transported on this makeshift hammock. I mean, it was quite an extraordinary experience. And I just had step two with me, you know, that my higher power was suffering with me. And then I was offered alcohol. I was offered alcohol as a painkiller. And I recoiled as if from a hot flame, just like it says in our 10th step promises that we will. Just like it says in our 10th step promises that we will. I reacted sanely and normally. The problem had been removed. It was not an issue. It was not at all a temptation. It was so simple. I just said, no, thank you. And the power of you and the thinking was so clear. Like, I knew I was going to come to this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and be accountable to you in the future and say, there's absolutely nothing a drink will make better. And AA works. And I knew I would be able to share with newcomers this story and say, it is possible to stay sober no matter what. And there is no way, I am so protective of Alcoholics Anonymous, there is no way I'm ever going to let anyone say AA doesn't work, because I am living proof that it does. So those are very much the stories that I wanted to share with you this evening. I will read to you from the family afterward. You know, I also need to kind of sober my family up. I kind of forgot about that part because I told the step 6 and 7 story and then didn't sort of carry on. I have beautiful relationships with my parents today as a result of my working steps 8 and 9. I'm really close with, when I had my accident in Africa, when I eventually got to a place where there was cell phone service, the first person I texted was my dad. What a miracle. And all I said was, emergency, can't explain, come to Africa. And he started to do what he needed to do to get things in order to travel in the midst of a global pandemic. And when I was able to give him more information, he flew to South Africa, where I had been medevaced. And he stayed with me for, 6 or 8 weeks after my accident. Even made the pee-pee bottle for me, which he was very proud of. And my mom is my neighbor. We hang out. We're buddies. You know, we're politically very different. I was campaigning for the candidate of my choice, and she came out to support me. You know, she even came backstage and she was like, honey, you were perfect. They are so lucky to have you. Because those are the kinds of relationships I have today as a result of these 12 steps. So in the family afterword on page 124, it says, experience is the thing of supreme value in life. That is true only if one is willing to turn the past to good account. We grow by our willingness to face and rectify errors and convert them into assets. This painful past may be of infinite value to other families still struggling with their problem. We think each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not. And when the occasion requires, each member should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. I know for me, my past was pretty dark. As it says in the doctor's opinion, my problems piled up on me and seemed astonishingly difficult to solve. And today I live by what it also says in the book, that I avoid the deliberate manufacture of misery. And I'm pretty sure my higher power wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. And it's all a result of, you know, what I shared from the preface, that these 12 steps are a series of principles, spiritual in nature, that enable me to live usefully and happily whole. So thank you so much for the opportunity to share with you this evening. It's been a pleasure and a delight. I hope if there's anyone new that you heard something with which you can identify, I hope you'll keep coming back and reach out to someone to sponsor you if you don't have a sponsor yet. And above all, peace be with you. Thank you so much.